Chocolate is on the minds of many this Easter weekend, so we're taking you to an island laser-focused on producing top-quality cocoa. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Victoria Craig. Good morning. Before we head to the warm shores of Africa's Sao Tome, we'll stop first in Shanghai, where there are signs of growing tension as China's biggest city enters its third week of a strict COVID-19 lockdown. Video has emerged that shows clashes between police and residents who are being removed from their homes, which are set to be turned into quarantine centers. We've been telling you this week about growing outrage over limited access to food and other basic essentials across the financial capital. Now, senior executives from a number of major Chinese companies have warned the lockdown could soon have an impact on the nation's economy. The BBC's Stephen McDonnell has more on that story.
Parts of China's manufacturing sector might soon have to close, at least temporarily, because companies can't get essential components from locked-down Shanghai. The president of electrical vehicle manufacturer Xiaopeng has warned of considerable disruption. He Xiaopeng said, if work doesn't start again in Shanghai during May, potentially all automobile factories across the country might have to stop operating. Yu Chengdong, customer services chief executive at tech giant Huawei, also warned that all tech-based industrial companies linked to Shanghai's supply chain could stop production if work doesn't resume in the lockdown city next month.
That's the BBC's Stephen McDonnell reporting there. Well, there are not many numbers to check since most markets are closed for Good Friday today, but some shares were still trading in parts of Asia. The Shanghai Composite Index and Tokyo's Nikkei ended down 0.4% and 0.2%. Oil prices were higher as the shortened trading week came to an end yesterday. That's as investors wait for details of an embargo the European Union is said to be drafting on Russian oil supplies. It's a move Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky will likely welcome. As war there enters day 50, in an interview with the BBC, he criticized European countries that are still buying Russian oil and gas, saying they have blood on their hands and are funding Vladimir Putin's war machine.
We don't understand how you can make money out of blood. Unfortunately, this is what some countries have been doing. For example, the oil embargo is, I think, one of the key issues which we know has been blocked by Germany and Hungary among European countries. And we need to talk together with these countries on how it's possible for there to be different attitudes to this issue, the oil embargo, within the European Union.
Oil prices are also a focus for airlines contending with cost fluctuations as a consequence of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Sweeping Western sanctions have meant most major international airlines have already stopped flying to Russia. UAE flag carrier Emirates, though, is not one of them, as the BBC's Samir Hashmi reports from Dubai.
This is because the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, has taken a neutral stance in this war. They have not condemned Russia. They have not imposed any kind of restrictions. They are continuing to do business with Russia. And they also share close political ties with them. So that's one of the key reasons why Emirates is still flying. And the reason they've stated is that they're actually catering to the average people in Russia who have nothing to do with this war. They're sending supplies which are not sanctioned and which are needed in the country, and also catering to the diplomatic class. I spoke to Sir Tim Clark, who's the president of Emirates Airline, and this is what he had to say when I asked him this question.
So you're kind of catering to those that are on the periphery of the main issue here. And I think that that's probably the way the government looks at it.
So Samir, can Emirates then decide on its own that it wants to stop flights to Moscow and St. Petersburg?
No, it can't, because the airline is owned by the Dubai government. They take these decisions when it comes to where to fly, where not to fly, especially when it's related to geopolitics. So if they ask Emirates to stop flying, they would.
That's not my call. It's the government's call, the UAE, the government of Dubai. If we are told to stop, we will stop. Unless we're told otherwise, we will continue.
Samir, obviously, these decisions by airlines around the world to stop their flights to Russia have consequences for the broader airline industry. What's Emirates' view on that?
If there is a scenario where Russia is isolated from the global economy, that would force airlines to rethink about routes. They'll have to rejig, really, the way Europe operates in terms of flight routes to Asia and other parts of the world.
The BBC's Samir Hashmi for us in Dubai. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. Nice talking to you, Victoria.
Allow yourself to be transported now to the small island nation of Sao Tome, just off Africa's west coast. The continent's smallest economy was once the world's biggest cocoa exporter, although it now produces just a fraction of global consumption. Growers there insist it's quality over quantity that matters most to consumers. From a sunny spot with a chocolate bar in hand, the BBC's Tamsin Ford told me why the country was knocked from its top cocoa-producing spot.
These islands were uninhabited until their discovery by Portuguese explorers in the 15th century, who brought slaves to work the land. And then in the 19th and 20th centuries, the plantations began producing coffee and cocoa. Chocolate manufacturers like Cadbury's, Roundtree's and Fry's, they all bought their beans from here. And that was until about somewhere in the 1920s, when after an expose of these horrific slave-like working conditions in America's Harper's magazine. And so by the end of the 1920s, all these companies switched their source of beans to Ghana and Ivory Coast.
So they say that they have the world's best quality cocoa. Is that true?
Well, it's quite a subjective claim, isn't it? Although the cocoa here does taste very different to the cocoa I've tried in Ivory Coast or Ghana, for various reasons. So the chocolate producers here have much more control. In West Africa, not to get into too much detail, but farmers ferment and then dry their beans themselves before selling them. And here, they sell them straight from the pod. It does mean they get less money per kilo, but it means that the producers have much more control over the fermentation process, which is where a lot of the taste comes in. And this is what Sao Tome prides itself on, the taste of chocolate. I spoke to President Carlos Villanova, and ultimately he told me that when you are such a tiny nation, you can't focus on quantity, so it has to be the quality.
There are a typical specimen of cocoa that you can get only in Sao Tome. Almendralado, it's very tasteful and very quality. And we also decided to produce biological cocoa only. So that makes it with high very quality.
So Tamsin, it's like this push and pull between quantity and quality, and Ivory Coast is still the world's biggest exporter. What are the biggest differences then between the country's cocoa sectors?
I would say the main thing I've noticed, and I lived in Ivory Coast for about 6 years for the BBC, so I've reported a lot on cocoa, but cocoa is very political in Ivory Coast. It produces a big chunk of the GDP, and the quantity of cocoa sold at every harvest is really a highly guarded secret. You can be thrown in jail if you release figures, and that's because it can have such a big effect on the market cocoa price. So it's very difficult to get access to these small plantations because farmers are very wary of talking to journalists. The other difference I've found is that in Ivory Coast, and indeed in Ghana, it's also another big exporter. It's very much local Ivorian, Ghanaian, sometimes Burkinabe, smallholders that produce the cocoa. On average, sort of 5 hectares of land. Here in Sao Tome, it's very foreign-owned. I visited an Italian, a French, there's also a South African, and they have much bigger plantations. It's hard to find foreign-owned cocoa. Indeed, there are other foreign-owned commodities out in West Africa, but it's hard to find foreign-owned cocoa plantations in Ivory Coast. And then finally, the last thing I've really noticed a big difference is that Ivory Coast is all about cocoa, but it's not all about chocolate. Here in Sao Tome, there's a real tree-to-bar sort of message. There are chocolate factories here, you can buy chocolate here, and that ultimately means a lot of the wealth remains here. Not all of it, of course, but more of it.
So Tamsin, we've been talking about quality and quantity of this chocolate. I can hear the birds in the background. I'm getting quite jealous of your location today, but I'm curious what this chocolate actually tastes like.
Well, I do have some here. This one actually has pepper and salt in it. And the biggest thing, hang on, the biggest thing that you notice, let me take a bite, is the smoothness. It really does taste very different. And I don't want to be a PR person for the Sao Tomean chocolate, but there is something very different about it. And I think that's because the producers have so much more control over the beans and the fermentation process that I spoke about. Whereas in Ivory Coast, farmers get more per kilo per bean because they ferment and dry the beans themselves. So ultimately, producers here just have more control over the final taste. So as you heard from the president there, they can't focus on quantity because they are such a tiny island, but they can put all their efforts into quality.
The BBC's Tamsin Ford for us in Sao Tome. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, here's hoping your basket is overflowing with chocolate this holiday weekend. In London, I'm Victoria Craig with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.